Hi everyone, Tim here with a quick note at the top of the episode. We experienced some audio quality issues in this recording, and we do apologize for that. We hope you'll still listen to the episode, it's a fun one, but regardless, please know that we'll be improving the audio quality in future episodes. As always, thanks for listening. Welcome to Single Serving Cinema with Tim and Tay, a podcast that looks at one critical scene in a movie every other week. We explore how the scene is constructed, what the scene achieves, and what it can tell us about the movie as a whole. While we won't needlessly spoil any of the movies we talk about, we will go where the discussion leads us, and so it's recommended that you watch the movie before you listen. I'm Tim.
And I'm Tay. How's it going, everybody?
Welcome to another episode of the show. We're getting into a bit of a rhythm here and looking down the barrel of a really fun movie this week.
It's a pretty divisive movie in horror movie circles, like as far as audiences go. A lot of people have a lot of hate towards this movie, and then a lot of people have developed this massive cult following. So really excited to talk to everybody today about Sam Raimi's 2009 film Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah, this is, I think, a really fun movie, and it fits really nicely into the type of movie we look for on this podcast. Sam Raimi is obviously really well known for the Spider-Man trilogy, but also before that, his really foundational works with the Evil Dead trilogy.
Yeah, two major trilogies. Sam Raimi is, like, he's not really known for many other movies outside these two trilogies, but obviously both go into movie cinema history as iconic and definitive of their genres. I still think Spider-Man, that original trilogy, minus the third movie maybe, is still some of the stronger or early superhero work.
Absolutely. I think he set a tone for superhero movies in that, and it's a tone that wasn't entirely copied or cribbed by filmmakers that followed him. Obviously, the MCU has its very specific equation that goes together into putting all those movies, but no one really achieved, I think, this balance that he did in his between a bit of melodrama, a bit of comedy. He took the source material very seriously, but he also, I think, represented the showy, colorful nature of comics.
Yeah, the zaniness of comics, maybe?
Absolutely. He's, as we'll get into, he really has this ability to play with tone and to jump from things that almost approach camp in how ridiculous they are to something that's really grounded in a very personal character drama.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to get into it today, but I think one of the reasons why his style is so difficult to duplicate is because he's so unique and very few people can pull off the amount of tones that Sam Raimi can juxtapose in a movie. It goes from completely off-the-wall comedy to pretty visceral horror, and this movie is a really good representation of that, like in a more horror-oriented genre movie than obviously Spider-Man, more towards like what he was doing with Evil Dead, but I'd say this is like a step more towards the horror side, a little less campy, but still has a lot of those elements.
And all this lead up I think is worth talking about, because Drag Me to Hell is the one they did right after he finished the Spider-Man trilogy. It was a bit of a return to form for him. It's an earlier script that he had, and if you've seen the third Spider-Man movie, you can imagine that maybe at that point Sam Raimi was a little tired of working on massive budget movies that are very subservient to studio oversight and notes. And so getting back down to a relatively simple horror movie must have been a nice breath of fresh air.
Well, as we're going to talk about today too, though, the production on this was a nightmare, akin to what he was dealing with on the Evil Dead trilogy, from what I've heard. The production was hell for some of these actors who had to literally go through hell to make this movie, ironically enough. Yeah. I think we've done enough preamble, though. Maybe you want to get into the overall summary of the movie, Tim?
Absolutely. So, Drag Me to Hell, it's a 2009 horror feature, and as we've said, it's directed by Sam Raimi, and it stars Alison Lohman, Justin Long, and Lorna Raver. Lohman plays Christine Brown, an ambitious loan officer at a bank who, in pursuit of a promotion, decides to evict an elderly woman from her home. The woman, played by Raver, curses Christine, giving her 3 days until a malicious spirit, the Lamia, will drag her to hell.
Ooh. And yeah, we always do the tagline, so I'll read this one out. Christine Brown has a good job, a great boyfriend, and a bright future, but in 3 days, she's going to hell.
And it really is essentially that simple, which is,
yeah,
I think part of the charm of this movie is it's a return to form for Raimi, obviously going back to horror, but it also calls back to far simpler horror movies than the kinds that we see today, where this is just about someone who did something, they had a consequence, and they have this much time to fix it. and everything's going to happen right within those stakes. It's not really going to dwell away from it. I think it's a really simple premise and a very effective story.
It does kind of have that return to simpler horror where it's about the unknown. There's so much of, like, the horror comes from what we don't know in this movie. And I think that kind of set a tone for the, like, 2010s as a decade of horror that kind of had that return to, like, the more ominous, some, like, return to ritual kind of style horror. And then also, like, the more, like, malevolent spirit kind of horror that I think was lost for a period of time in the 90s. And, of course, Sam Raimi's the one to bring it back.
Yeah, that would definitely be his bag, is to set the tone and then not necessarily ever return to this type of thing after. Because, I mean, he did Drag Me to Hell, and then after that, he did Oz the Great and Powerful.
That's it.
And his next directing credit is for the MCU. He's going to do the Doctor Strange sequel, which I think bodes really well for the Doctor Strange series and for the MCU. I'm not sure what it'll mean for Raimi, but I guess we'll find out next year.
It's kind of funny we started talking about, like, the superhero universes at the beginning of this podcast, because, like, I think Sam Raimi is someone who could completely shift that genre once again, maybe with this new Doctor Strange movie.
It's entirely possible. I'm really interested to see how much of this movie, especially in terms of the MCU, gets to be a product of his direction and his authorial intent, because obviously that's not a given in terms of that sort of setting and that production environment.
Yeah, say what you want about the Marvel Universe and how well it's handled all these characters and storylines, but one thing it has really lacked, in my opinion, is authorial vision by, like, a director who comes in with their vision and changes the movies to make it more like their style, less like what the overseers of the Marvel Universe are wanting. So I think Sam Raimi is going to be a welcomed injection of uniqueness and ingenuity for that universe.
It'll be nice to potentially see some personality in the Marvel Universe, for sure. I'm looking forward to the possibility for that, at least. Mm-hmm. But before we move on, one thing I did want to touch on is you were talking about how this sort of sparked maybe a return to the subject matter of demons and possessions, sort of spiritual horror. But in terms of its tone, hopefully you've watched this movie already and now you're listening to this episode like a good audience member, and you'll know that this movie is a lot of fun. It's pretty wacky. It goes from silly to dark very quickly. And what I wonder about is whether or not horror movies like this exist anymore right now, because really our market is saturated with either like James Wan franchises and their many, many, many sequels, or like prestige stuff from A24, which is extremely metaphorical and, you know, 2.5 hours long and shot very particularly, neither of which represents this tone that you have in this movie.
Yeah, it's safe to say we're in a bit of a lull right now in terms of how there's a lack of progression in horror.
Mm-hmm.
As far as, you know, new themes, new topics, I haven't really seen anything that groundbreaking really since maybe like Midsommar, which I'm not even highly praising that. I'm just saying, like, that was a unique mark in horror recently. Yeah. Other than that, though, I think we're due for something to kind of ratify the system again.
Well, even just, I would love to see more of this sort of fun horror come back, especially, you know, from a big name with a bigger budget, because I think it's kind of relegated to the more indie layer of horror right now. Like, I don't know if you saw from a couple years ago, Krampus maybe falls into it, or Happy Death Day to You.
Yeah, because those are actually like very quality directors that really had cool visions for their products, and those movies were incredibly financially successful and have like at least Happy Death Day has sequels.
Yeah, absolutely. But they definitely didn't have the money this one did. I mean, Drag Me to Hell was made for $30 million. I don't think they'd be working with that on movies like that. Same with last year, Blumhouse put out Freaky, which is the one where a high school teenager switches bodies with Vince Vaughn, who's a murderer. Very silly horror concept and not entirely successful throughout, but that kind of thing. And like Cabin in the Woods, I'd say, has a lot of tone DNA in common with Drag Me to Hell. And that's, I think they're really fun movies. They feel like that kind of fright night, like you go, you know, you're going to laugh and you know, you'll get some good scares. And it doesn't feel as common an experience right now.
No, well, you mentioned like this $30 million budget, and I think Sam Raimi is one of few directors who probably could have received that much money to make this movie at the time. Like, but I see you got the stats up here. It made $90 million at the box office. That's a pretty good return, and that's why I don't know. I think we stressed on this podcast before that these are the kind of movies we want to see being made more, like these $30 million to $50 million movies that have a lot of box office potential, and maybe they can be swing and misses sometimes. But I think that the potential for uniqueness is there with this level of budget and with hiring cool directors like Sam Raimi to have a vision for the product.
Yeah, I think that's what you're kind of losing right now is this mid-budget range, right? You either have people who they know they're going to do something indie and they're going to sell it big or work directly with someone like Blumhouse or A24, or you're someone like Chloe Zhao where you make a really successful, beautiful, smaller movie like Nomadland, and then you get hired to make something in a franchise like Eternals, which is just, they just put out the trailer for it now. So you do have this disappearing middle market, especially in horror, but I think in a lot of movies. And it's a shame.
I guess this is a level of budget that never really did exist in horror, ultimately. I mean, they were always kind of smaller budget movies, and then they kind of, maybe at their most prestigious, were at this level of budget. Their horror movies are rarely given a major budget to work with.
Yeah.
And that's why they tend to be movies that land earlier in promising directors' careers.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, is that even now, regardless of who you are, to try to get tens of millions of dollars for your horror project is not necessarily going to happen. It's a genre that's historically lended itself towards making the most out of very little in a budget, and that's where you get all these great innovations in terms of the effects and how they can stretch a budget.
Yeah, and you know what? Maybe that's a good time to jump into this scene, because this scene is a landmark scene in horror, in my opinion, just as at least in terms of recent horror movies, just in terms of its complexity and what it was able to do under such budgetary constraints. I mean, based on what we've read leading up to this podcast, there is a ton of resources devoted to it and a ton of time devoted to it, but it was executed so well and effectively that I think it makes this movie what it is almost.
Absolutely. This is a key scene, and as compared to some of the other movies I'm sure we'll talk about, it's not like the issue where you're looking at just the one good scene. But yeah, this scene, especially in terms of production, there's some interesting stuff about how they film the scene and how they get inside a small space that we can talk about. But I suppose if you want to dive into our scene summary, we can let everyone know what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So the scene takes place 16 minutes and 41 seconds into the movie and goes to 22:37. So it's a 6-minute scene, which is pretty impressive for what happens in this. It's actually crazy.
Yeah, it's action-packed, to be sure.
So the scene stars Alison Lohman and Lorna Raver. After being told she is a shoo-in for the big promotion, Christine leaves the office, venturing into the underground parking garage with her office supplies. Once inside her car, she is violently attacked by the disgruntled client, Mrs. Ganoush, for shaming her earlier in the day. In a chaotic fight scene, the women attack each other within the tight confines of the car, involving staplers, handkerchiefs, a smashed window, and several car stunts. The scene ends with Mrs. Ganoush cursing Christine by taking a button off her jacket and handing it back to her. Christine passes out. End scene.
Yeah, this is, as I said earlier, it's an action-packed scene. There's a lot that goes on in it, and it's the, I guess you could say it's the inciting incident in terms of the horror mechanics at play. The scene ends with Mrs. Ganoush cursing her, and that propels the rest of the story until the end of the movie.
I guess, yeah, it's pretty close to the end of, I guess this would be the end of the first act.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the first act, it ends on a big note. This is a dense scene. There's a lot of great action in it. There's a lot of Sam Raimi style action in it that we'll get into, especially like the way it's filmed, the sound effects that are used. It goes hard into both just, I think, very, very clear hand-to-hand action and even slapstick, and then some sort of gross-out action as well.
Yeah, I think maybe I want to start by saying that this movie was like a PG movie with the intention of being a PG-13 movie, which also probably should have gone in our budgetary conversation, because that's probably why they were given this much money to make this movie.
Yeah, I don't have the link in front of me right now. It's maybe something I can verify earlier, and I'll throw in the show notes if I can find it. But I do believe I read somewhere that actually Raimi intended it to be PG-13. It wanted it to be more accessible. And again, I think that lends itself to this sort of fun Fright Night drive-in tone of this movie, where
right.
you could go right. if you were you're a teenager, you can go see this, and you're not going to see what you'd see in, like, you know, Saw or some sort of gore porn movie.
But at the same time, like, that all being said, this scene sticks with me because of how revolting some of the parts are.
It's pretty gross, but I think in a fun way, you know?
Totally fun, and it's amazing that it's PG-13, because, I don't know, the emotional roller coaster that this scene takes you on is just surprising at the end of it that this is a PG-13 scene. But there really is nothing overly graphic in nature. It's simply scary. That's just a testament to Sam Raimi's filmmaking.
Yeah, it's scary, it's visceral, like, your combination of how it's filmed and the sound effects that you use, and there's so many great, like, less than a second insert shots, reaction shots, things like that, that really put you right in it and make you feel these hits and these gross sensations that occurring. It's really effective, and I really like that it stuck with this PG-13 thing. There is, we should note, a director's cut that is R-rated, and it appears to just be R-rated because they just added more yes. blood into sequences where there were already blood. So I don't know which came first, which one's the chicken and which one's the egg here, but it does feel like you built a PG-13 movie and then it was like, people who love Sam Raimi, they can get his director's cut and we'll see more blood throughout the movie.
Yeah, honestly, I had never seen the non-director's cut, like the PG-13 cut, until researching for this podcast. My Blu-ray has both versions on it, so I've always watched the unrated version because that's usually my preference for how to watch a movie mm-hmm. like this, with two options. But this being, like, for this podcast, this was something we really wanted to discuss, and it's pretty impressive how there's very little change between a PG-13 and rated R version of this movie. That it's just, like Tim said, a little additional blood where there was already blood before.
And that, I mean, that goes to show that, again, a lot of horror, it doesn't have to operate on seeing the terrible thing happen or showing highly surgical or highly gory processes. A lot of the effective horror can just come down to employing really simple tools. And maybe if we want to dive into some of the horror tropes at play here, right at the beginning of the scene, one of the main ones, and this is one we talked about in the Creasy episode, is that you get some first person perspective from Christine as she's approaching her car. And that's when she starts to realize that, you know, something's wrong.
So the very first shot of the scene that we're talking about is like when she enters the parking garage. And mm-hmm. that is, I believe, the only static shot of the whole scene. It's locked off on a tripod, and she kind of, you hear like the very traditional horror sound of like the door creaking closed, mm-hmm. and then like the empty sounds for walking. But that first shot is static, and I think that's really important for just kind of all is okay in that first moment. And then, like Tim said, then you start getting the POV shots, and you start realizing something's bad is going to happen.
Yeah. You start getting a bit of a shaky first-person perspective, and she spots Mrs. Ganish's car, which we should note is that Sam Raimi's car?
Oh, so it's the car from The Evil Dead, which apparently is in every one of Sam Raimi's movies, even ones that don't take place in the modern age. I haven't seen the one, I can't remember what the movie's called.
I haven't spotted it in Army of Darkness. I don't have that in my memory, where he's, you know, centuries back.
But it's
a 73 cool. Oldsmobile Delta 88, which he has Mrs. Ganish drive.
Well, we never actually see her drive it, unfortunately, because that would be iconic.
Oh, that's true. I wonder, maybe, who knows, maybe it didn't even run. But they do, in the scene before this, they establish that it's Mrs. Ganish's when she leaves the bank after being shamed by Christine. Mm-hmm. And then in Christine's perspective, she comes into the parking garage and she spots this Oldsmobile, and you get this great little musical sting, which is almost more of a sound effect. Christopher Young composed the music for this, and there's this great little sting when you see this Oldsmobile. It's like a harmonized violin line that sounds like a car horn, because your car horns, they have more than one tone at play. It's the kind of thing where, you know, if you listen for it, you'll hear it, and it's a great little note. And
does it start with car horns and then turn into that, or is that all score?
I think like it sounds like violins to me, but they're arranged in the sort of tones that you would associate with a car horn. There's a lot more, totally. I think, music theory to delve in there, but that's what it sounds like to me, and it's just one step further in destabilizing the scene for Christine, where, as Taylor said, you start in this locked off camera, and then it gets shakier. she realizes that Mrs. Ganesh is still in the parking garage, and then it's, you know, it's a this little slow race to get into her car, where she thinks she'll be safe.
Yeah, I think you hear like the Mrs. Ganesh traditional cough, and then you're kind of like, oh, she is in this parking garage.
Yeah.
And you realize it's not in Christine's head. And then as soon as Christine gets in the car, then she's attacked. And there's that excellent 360 pan shot following the CGI handkerchief.
Which, yeah, the handkerchief looks good enough, I'd say.
It's good enough.
But you can tell because, I mean, I don't know how you're supposed to get a handkerchief to act and go where you want it to. But I do love, like, in terms of horror tropes, one thing that I really like is they do use the handkerchief in a jump scare. Christine's watching it sort of float towards her car and float around, and then it falls out of view, and it comes back with like the schlockiest, most obvious, like big orchestra string stinger, and Christine jumps, and then they slowly pan in the interior of the car, and there is no jump scare for when they reveal that Mrs. Ganesh is right behind her driver's seat and waiting for her. And I like that you give the jump scare to the, in theory, non-threatening handkerchief, and you don't give the jump scare to Mrs. Ganesh, the intruder in her space.
I don't know, that handkerchief almost screws her over later, too, when she's driving. It almost makes her crash.
She does.
That handkerchief very, I don't know, it's a threat.
Yeah, and it's a theme that I want to talk about a little bit later, but I do think in terms of just imagery, I don't think there's a lot of deeper stuff at play here, but in terms of imagery, there's a lot of old world, new world, age versus youth at play, and I think a handkerchief is not the worst token of the elderly to use like that, especially because it was in previous scenes, it was set up to be kind of gross in association. She puts her dentures on it, she's sneezing and coughing into it,
yeah,
all these things that you associate with age.
Really good use of bodily fluid horror, too, I gotta say, throughout the movie.
Yeah, you've seen the movie, so you know what we're talking about.
I believe what plagues you is the Lamia.
Lamia, that's the word the old woman used.
The black goat, only summoned by gypsies for their darkest deeds.
So just to dive into some of the beats of the scene, because I think they're super entertaining, and there's a fair bit to talk about in them. After you've revealed that Mrs. Ganesh is in the car behind her, she immediately grabs Christine's hair and lunges at her earring, which by the end of the scene, you'll figure out she needs an item of hers to curse her. So she goes for the earring first.
Right.
By the end of the scene, she goes for the button. Christine was bringing out because she had to do a bunch of work at home. She's bringing all these office supplies home, and that ends up being many of the weapons that are used in the scene. So you have... She attacks her with a stapler, which the sound effects make it sound like a sword. There's these great insert shots of her swinging it behind her. And then you've got these phenomenal prosthetics of Mrs. Ganesh's face with like a stapled shut eye and staples embedded in her forehead.
Apparently, Lorna Raver did get dinged by that tool. I don't think it was a real stapler, but Alison Lohman did strike her with it when they were doing that scene. I think that's the shot that's in the movie.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised because, again, it's a really small space to work in. And on that note, they actually also, they mentioned in the production of this is one of the earliest scenes they did, and they had to use what they call a puzzle car.
Yeah, so very the cool.
The car fits all together as one, so you have to film it as a whole. But otherwise, you can take one part of the car at a time and fit a camera in. So if you're focusing on Christine in the driver's seat, Mrs. Ganesh in the back seat, or in the passenger seat, as she is later, It's a great way to get in and film these shots, which all follow this very established Raimi style that you'd recognize from parts of Spider-Man and a lot from Evil Dead.
Yeah, I'd say if without the car being able to be taken apart, you couldn't get like 90% of the shots in this scene. They used every tool at their disposal to make sure Raimi could do these dynamic camera movements. And if you see some of the behind the scenes, some of the rigs that they have the cameras on just to get like the precise sweeps and tilts and pans. Mm-hmm. Really cool stuff.
And all of this lends itself towards Raimi's very iconic clarity of action.
Yeah.
In our notes, you had noted that like this is the opposite of the Paul Greengrass style. And I think it's interesting that like this is right dead center in the Bourne series timeline. Like it's eight, like I think it's those movies span like 16 years, and I think this is about 7 or 8 years into it in 2009. So it's a funny counterpoint there that
I didn't even realize
action in this Yeah, the action in this, you're stuck in this tiny car and you see everything that's happening because he gives you the time to have these reaction shots where he does this. Maybe what I would associate with Raimi more than anything else is this sort of quick zoom in on a character's face.
The punch
in. See their reaction. So, yeah, you get a punch in when Ganesh has one of her eyes stapled shut and a bunch of staples in her forehead, and she kind of like growls and starts her next attack.
Mm-hmm. And these are quick shots, just like what we're talking about with Paul Greengrass, but completely different way of shooting them. These are usually locked on or like have a very specific, precise motion to the movement of the camera, whereas someone like Paul Greengrass in the Bourne trilogy, and I'm really not trying to rip on Paul Greengrass specifically, but he did set this style up to be a dominant way to do action in Hollywood, and it's whipping the camera to be so disorienting that you can barely follow the action, and there's moments where that can work. I think the disorientation is like can be valuable in some movies. This movie and this scene specifically really benefit from allowing us to see each action as its own shot without whipping the camera so we lose sight of what we're actually supposed to see. Every shot is precise, and that's also like why we were talking earlier that this scene's very visceral and why certain moments stick out, because it's not like whipping around trying to like show us the chaos of the moment. It's showing us like the impactful moments, and the camera's lingering on them long enough for us to see them.
Yeah, if you can't see the hits happen, and if you can't see the reaction from the hits, you're not going to feel them. And I think that's why like Greengrass did the right thing. If he wanted to have like someone who verges on superhuman, like just the ultimate soldier, then yeah, let's make him move so fast you don't even follow him.
Right.
He's just disarmed two cops and has their guns. In this one, the point of the scene is you want to feel like you just got stapled in the forehead. Mm-hmm. So you have to see the stapler move, you have to see it hit Mrs. Ganesh, and then you have to see Mrs. Ganesh grimace and react to it. And all that builds to this visceral, clear sequence.
Yeah, and they said that the scene was incredibly difficult for both the actors to shoot because Raimi was very precise in how he wanted to do this, and he literally couldn't really have them pulling punches. So they did have stunt doubles, but as far as I read, Alison Lohm did most of her own stunt work, and Lorna Raver did as much as she possibly could do for the scene. And they actually hit each other. They actually choked each other, they pulled each other's real hair, and they actually hit each other. And all this was because Sam Raimi actually needed them to have that clarity of action, because he's not tricking the audience. He wanted them to feel every time that one of these characters gets struck or hit or choked or hair pulled out, you're supposed to feel it.
I mean, we didn't talk about this earlier about sort of our first experiences with this. I don't really remember how I came across this movie. I do remember the scene with the embalming fluid, which is, you know, that just kind of gets burned into your memory.
Honestly, this scene, though, the scene or the part where Mrs. Ganesh loses her dentures and then like locks her toothless jaw onto Christine's mouth is so scary to me. That is one of the most disturbing images I've maybe ever seen.
It's so creative in interaction,
it's
right?
Gross.
There are so many things you can do where you're like, two people are fighting inside a car. What are they going to do? I don't know. Maybe they'll try to choke each other out. They'll punch each other. They'll push each other around. But yeah, there's a point where Christine, while she's being attacked by Miss Ganesh, she jams her foot down on the gas, drives a car forward, and uses it essentially as a weapon, throwing Mrs. Ganesh, who doesn't have a seatbelt on, directly into the dash. And both all her dentures, they get shattered and smash out of her mouth. And she attacks Christine by, like, biting and sucking on her face. And I think that's a puppet, right? That, like, Alison Lohman is fighting with?
I would guess for that one shot.
There's something so stiff about it.
Well, because the jaw is, like, way too big for it to be Lorna Raver's.
Yeah, it's there, and I think that works way better. I'm sure it was more comfortable for both the actresses
at
the time.
Yeah, not to suck on her jaw.
Yeah, but the stiffness of, like, that puppet that Alison Lohman is fighting with, I think, lends to the creepiness of that particular interaction. And it is the one where I feel if you look this up on, like, Reddit boards and stuff, people will talk about, like, you know, an old woman sucking on your chin. It sticks with you.
It definitely stuck with me at the first time viewing. It's one of my only things that I remember feeling right after my first watch of this.
Mm-hmm. And I did, before we move too far away from the handkerchief, I did want to ask you, what do you think about the jump scare? Because I feel like it's an easy thing for current film criticism to be like, oh, jump scares are cheap. They are easy. They're too simple. And they, if you see a jump scare in a movie, it's a bad horror movie. Do you agree with that?
I agree with part of that principle. I think relying on jump scares is something that lazy directors do too often.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that there's a problem inherently with using a jump scare in a movie if it's necessary. I think if it's something that scares the character, like within the story, then it's, you can use a jump scare plausibly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that overusing it really is a detriment to the audience first and foremost, because you lose all that excitement when the jump scare happens, and then you're like on a down. And mm-hmm. ideally after a scare, I think you want to be on a high.
Yeah.
I get, this is going to take me into like one of my deeper thoughts on Raimi, so I don't know if we want to go yet.
No, we'll jump around.
But I think Raimi is a rare example of being so aware of what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And this was one of my big questions for you about the movie in general and Raimi's style is like, is he like the ultimate postmodern filmmaker in being able to juxtapose these incredibly cheesy elements? Like we've talked about, like the handkerchief jump scare, the really obvious use of stings and very conventional score to get across his points, and then really borderline Looney Tunes action happening throughout this scene and throughout the movie. But he's doing it in such a meticulous way because he's also using things like extreme close-ups that are like made very clear to make the action mm-hmm. really clear. He's also using, you know, high caliber acting and action sequence directing. And I just think that it's too aware of itself to like lend to this idea that it's unintentional or that this movie's stupid. There, it just feels like there's something missing from that argument.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And tying this back in with the jump scare thing, I think jump scare in the right hands is just an effective tool. And it, when deployed at the right time, it does what it's supposed to do and it leaves the audience where they should be, right? Like if you are trying to double fake out an audience where you know there's a monster in that vent and you're waiting for it to jump out. And I think there's like 3 or 4 movies easily that do this, Alien being the one in my mind, where you're waiting for the monster to jump out and it turns out to be the cat, right? And you use that as a jump scare because you're trying to subvert the audience's expectations that
right.
they're going to see the alien right now. Just like in this one, I think right on the page, a simpler filmmaker, you'd be like, oh, the jump scare is when you see Mrs. Ganesh in the car. And instead, I love how calm, or yeah, you do one and you're like, oh, there's a jump scare, we're done. And then you do it again and then you wear your audience right out. But I love that the jump scare is attributed to this silly flying handkerchief. And then you very calmly and gracefully allow Mrs. Ganesh to enter the scene with that great lighting where she's all in shadow and she slowly moves in and you see like her cataract's eye first.
Yeah.
I think it's super effective.
The way the jump scare works in this scene is really effective because you get that initial like sting and the scare is supposed to like affect you as an audience member. And then Christine literally breathes a sigh of relief because she's like, okay, it was just my imagination. It's this stupid handkerchief.
Mm-hmm.
And then you as an audience member almost have that same reaction. And then you watch as her head kind of picks up again and her eyes start following it. And then mm-hmm. you get that POV shot and it follows you all the way around to Mrs. Ganesh. And you get that other moment of absolute fear because you're in that moment with the character. And I think it works so effectively, just the way that scare actually does lull you into the point of calmness that the character does.
Yeah, it's almost like another jump scare when you see Mrs. Ganesh would let you off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, you're in the car with her. The handkerchief is outside the car. The corny horror, the easy horror is outside the car. You're inside with Christine. She's stuck with Mrs. Ganesh. And then the action takes off. Before we get into the action, I think we should walk through some of the key points in it.
Sure.
Just going back to whether or not Raimi is like the only or what maybe the most notable postmodern filmmaker, I do think recently we've begun to see some more filmmakers bring this approach to what they're doing. And I think it comes from these filmmakers who are film nerds. They're so informed on the history that they're building upon.
Oh, yeah. If, like you, Raimi, if Raimi, you ever see Raimi in interviews, he is such a nerd.
And it's the same with like Edgar Wright or Ryan Johnson, right? Mm-hmm. These guys who are, all they're doing all the time is watching new movies and absorbing stuff. And then when they're making movies, all they're doing is referring to them, putting together homages to them and things like that. And I think you get these people who, they know what the tools are and they also know how to use them. They're not building off of the genre that they're in based on the most successful movie that came out last year, the year before. They're building off of the legacy of the genre that they're in. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest indicators of this is how they handle tone. And as we've talked about a couple times, Raimi's a master at making you feel like you can get away with any tone that you want in the scene. And I think it's getting harder. I think if you look at a lot of modern film criticism, a lot of people be like, oh, the tone was all over the place, or that part felt out of place with the rest of it. And sometimes they're right, it's not established properly or doesn't fit, but I think it's the mark of a more masterful filmmaker that they're able to jump from one to the next. And in Western cinema, I think it's rarer. You do have, you know, Raimi and Wright and Chris McQuarrie too, I think, in the Mission Impossible movies, the recent one. Mm-hmm. He's doing that to an extent. But then in Eastern cinema, like if you watch Parasite, that goes from super silly to super dark on the turn of a dime. I think shifts of tone are so much more allowed by audiences in Korean, in Hong Kong cinema. I think it's something we're missing out on over here, with the exception of filmmakers like Raimi.
Yeah, we definitely have standards that need to be met in American cinema to like reach mass audiences. And the fact that Sam Raimi works within those confines, yet still is able to produce pretty ingenious content that does, I don't know if it balances, but it definitely, his movies contain so many different tones within them. And to say that they're balanced is probably incorrect, but the fact that he is able to use them and that it all feels like his movie is probably one of the better compliments I can give a director.
Absolutely. Like it is something that you just don't see as much anymore. And even if you go back to the Spider-Man movies, obviously the third one had very, like almost people would probably argue, nauseating jumps in tone with how campy and silly some of the stuff got with evil Peter Parker. But I mean, in the first movie, I can still remember there's a very distinct feeling at play when Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin is just destroying Spider-Man at the end. The music drops out. It goes from this very colorful, broad superhero movie with very on-the-nose moments to being something way heavier and darker. So this is something he's obviously been able to pull off for a while. And even, you know, back to Evil Dead, as you've said before, there is Looney Tunes-esque action. There is slapstick humor. There's stuff that goes back to silent cinema where you have the legend Bruce Campbell fighting himself with his own hand, which is just unheard of today. I don't think it would be as palatable in a modern movie.
Well, no, because we have so much more awareness of the craft, I think, in general audiences, and you're kind of looking for those things. Now, one thing I will say about that is that if you have a good story and good characters that your audience is into, they tend to look at all the mistakes and the cheapness of the movie a lot less. Mm-hmm.
It goes a long way to say if you have an engaging story, if you have a justified tone, you'll get away with other stuff because people are going to be invested in the characters.
Well, yeah, and I don't know how you feel about these characters, but I definitely liked Alison Lohman's character a lot. Christine is a rare protagonist in contemporary cinema, I'd say, in the sense that she is a female, first and foremost, who is like looking to get ahead in her career. But then the fact that she is capable of making very human and sometimes bad decisions while kind of still being this protagonist hero is really cool, because she's very nuanced and very relatable because of all that.
Yeah, Sam Raimi and Ivan Raimi wrote this, and they had said that it was meant to be like a morality tale, which again throws back to very classic horror setups. And I do think you're right. Like, Christine in it is flawed and reasonable, and she shows initiative. She tries to do things, she has ambition, and she tries to learn from her mistakes and even rectify them. I think there's a lot to work with in her. When if you wanted to be more black and white, she'd be a far more horrible, ambitious person who immediately knows that if she evicts this woman from her house, she'll get ahead. But they give you all this time to establish that it wasn't an easy decision for her, and she had reasons that were established for why she thought it was okay. And they also go to an extent to make Mrs. Gannish seem like a not nice, unsanitary, aggressively unkind person over the course of leading up to when Christine renders the eviction.
Yeah, I know that Lorna Raver, in one of the interviews I saw, said that she had enormous sympathy towards her character after like reading the initial scene of Mrs. Gannish. Mm-hmm. But as an audience member, I didn't find any sense of sympathy after that scene specifically. It was like she's presented to be kind of disgusting, or maybe that's just old people things that she's doing, like old people behavior. And Sam Raimi is very intentional about these kinds of things.
Yeah,
she's presented to be pretty gross and unnerving and off-putting, and then she's also clearly way behind on all these payments. So by all accounts, and I don't know anything about banking, but Christine as a character seems to be in the right to make this decision, even though it's morally very difficult.
Yeah, taken at face value, I don't get the impression that Raimi wanted us to sympathize with her too much. I do think they give you the nice long scene where she's requesting an extension,
mm-hmm.
and that explains why she needs it, and she is in need, and there's this kind of old world concept where she goes so far as to beg Christine,
mm-hmm.
Which is a big deal to her, and Christine calls security on her and shames her, and that sort of launches this whole thing. That's why she curses her. But in that whole process, Christine says, you know, you have a daughter, could you live with her? They're assisted living homes. And Gannish sort of brushes that all away. She just wants her home, but she needs more time, even though she's multiple extensions past due. So if the story was supposed to be even, I don't think that's how it plays. I think they mark Mrs. Gannish as a pretty detestable antagonist, who just sort of launches Christine's torment for the remaining two acts of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
And I think maybe that's a good way to sum up this scene and why it's important. We pick this movie because it's maybe the Raimi movie you've never seen.
That's right.
And possibly the one you've never even heard of. And this scene in particular exemplifies so many of his strengths and why he works as a director, and why his action is clear, and why his movies are effective at making you feel something, regardless of how quickly he wants to whip pan from one tone to the next.
And I think even if you are a more serious film watcher, I think most of those kinds of people are Raimi fans. But if you're not into the zaniness and the more ridiculous elements of his filmmaking, then there's still a lot to cling on to in this movie. There's still a lot of really skillful technical filmmaking, and then there's really good horror elements.
Yeah, it's tense, it's spooky. It doesn't rely on some of the qualities that I think you expect from 9 out of 10 horror movies that you'll see right now. I really like that it's a fun movie and a fun horror movie. So with that, I think we can move to our shout-outs.
Okay, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'll start this time. I think you went first last time, so I appreciate that, Taylor.
I think it's because you weren't ready.
That also sounds like me. I just picked mine out just before we started recording.
Of course.
But I am ready this time.
Okay, go for it.
And my shout-out is to Alison Lohman as Christine. She has a couple points in the movie, these outbursts, because, again, she's trying very hard to be professional. She's trying to be a good girlfriend. She's meeting her boyfriend's parents, all these things where she has to be polite and even-mannered and things like that. But, of course, the undercurrent the whole time is she knows she will be dragged to hell in 3 days if she doesn't do something. So obviously that stress gets to her from time to time, and she sees things that upset her and she lashes out. And maybe the funniest line in the movie to me is when her coworker is drumming his fingers on her desk and the stress mounts up for her and she yells at him to get your filthy pig knuckle off my desk. And I don't know if it was Sam Raimi. I don't know if it's Ivan Raimi. I think it's a great line, and it makes me laugh every time. And maybe we'll try to get the audio cut into the episode. We'll see if we can get that.
And get your filthy pig knuckle off my desk!
apparently, Raimi lets his actors come up with a lot of their own lines. So, you know, it wouldn't even be surprising to hear that Alison Lohman, you know, threw that one in there.
That would definitely be fun. I like to think that she did.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, you don't see her in too many things, but she really delivers in this movie.
You also don't hear the term pig knuckle that often.
No, never hear that one.
Yeah.
my shout out was going to be Sam Raimi's return to form, but we did talk about that a lot. So I had a secondary and tertiary shout out as well. So my secondary shout out is to the grave digging scene, which I guess took 2 weeks of time to shoot. The grave digging scene. And Alison Lohman was really digging, and it was actually most of it was fake dirt. Which
I would hope so, because like wet dirt 6 feet down, that's a lot.
Apparently she has a fairly delicate skin, so it would have like really reacted with her and made her like turn red if she was in real soil. So they actually had to like use fake dirt, and like so you look at any behind the scenes and they're just dumping water down into this hole that she's in and shooting cameras down at her. And it sounds like it was hell, and I really wanted to give credit to both the production and to her for that scene, because it works really well. Like this scene that we discussed in the podcast today, it really holds up as like a scary and unique scene that doesn't rely on gratuitous gore to be scary.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really powerful sort of climactic scene for the movie. There's a lot of elemental stuff at play. And again, it's one more example of how committed Lohman was to this performance. So kudos to her. Okay, and for our outro, like usual, we each have a recommendation, something that we've watched recently that we think you should watch as well. I can hop in first.
Yeah, go for it.
My recommendation this time is a documentary called Coup 53. It's by the Iranian filmmaker Taghi Amirani, and it's about the coup in Iran in 1953 of Mossadegh, who was the first democratically elected prime minister in Iran, and he nationalized their oil supplies, which Britain obviously didn't like. And then ever since the coup, most people, like, they'd only ever gotten confirmation from the US in their role in the coup, and Great Britain never admitted to having a role in it. And in the course of this documentary, they uncover some very critical documentation that points towards Great Britain having a role in the coup. So it's pretty groundbreaking stuff. Yeah, it still hasn't been recognized by Great Britain. But it's also a super interesting documentary. There's some things that they do with how you tell the story and how you represent it that I think plays with the conventions of documentary. So I would recommend it. I'll put a link in the show notes of where you can find it. It's not streaming anywhere specifically, but you can rent it from a specific website.
Okay.
And I think you should.
That's a good recommendation. Not a lot of people that I know have seen that. And it sounds really interesting and, like you said, groundbreaking. Mm-hmm.
It was a fascinating one, and there's some extra stuff from a YouTube account that I like, where they talk with the filmmaker and the guy who edited it was Walter Murch, edited like Apocalypse Now and The Godfathers, a bunch of stuff for George Lucas. Really, really fascinating editor.
One of the more renowned editors, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Tons of awards. So I'll link that stuff as well in the show notes. Give it a look.
Wow, great. Okay, and my recommendation for the week is a movie I've been wanting to recommend for the past few, but because of all the Canadian cool stuff I've been watching, I put it off. This one is not a Canadian movie, but it is a low-budget indie movie called The Wolf of Snow Hollow, directed and written by Jim Cummings, and it's a 2020 movie. Jim Cummings, if you know anything about him, you'll know that he made a movie called Thunder Road for a very low budget, and he also wrote, produced, directed, and starred in that movie, which is very impressive for such a low budget movie. And the short actually won, I believe, best short at Cannes. But this movie is his follow up. This is his second feature film. And I love this movie. It's got this great ski town setting that's being ravaged by what seems like to be a werewolf. But there are so many refreshing twists and turns in this movie. Do not go into it thinking it's going to be your traditional werewolf movie. There's so much more personality and character at work here. And I think it will fly under the radar for most people. So definitely seek this one out.
Yeah, this is one you've told me about before, and like a good movie watcher, I put it on my list and I haven't watched it yet, so this is a good reminder. I'll circle back around to that and definitely check it out.
Yeah, please.
That's it for our episode today. I guess, if anything else, the lesson is be careful if you cross an old woman. She might curse you.
Beware of the Lamia.
Yeah, beware of the Lamia, and thank you for listening to the Single Serving Cinema podcast.